What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. Today, we're going to talk about a few different things. We're going to start out talking about Trump on trial because of all the, you know, of everything that's been going on with indictments for the last, I lose track at this point, a year plus, and appeals and all that kind of stuff. As we know, he is actually on trial right now in New York City. We're also going to talk about coming up the Trump immunity, hearing before the Supreme Court. But we just had this one that is obviously related to that, but about January 6th and the laws and the legal theories that the government used to prosecute a lot of the Jan 6th insurrectionists, right? So, you know, there's the trial about the coup, about the big people who were running everything. And then there's the ongoing ones that we know have been going on almost since Jan 6th itself. You know, the initial prosecutions got going of the people who actually broke in got going relatively quickly. So that happened. And then we're going to talk about something that kind of probably maybe is happening today as we record up on Capitol Hill. And just a reminder that we always almost always record these on Wednesday, just a touch after 12 o'clock on Wednesday. So that's where we are in time. It's quite possible that by the time you listen to this, that more will have happened on that front. But let's co-host Kate Riga. Let's dive right into this. So we've had a few days now of Trump up there, and we're not kind of to the trial proper. We have jury selection and all that. So what do you make of it so far? What do you make of what we're seeing?
So our colleague Josh Kavinsky has been there in person. You know, I guess they have this little kind of media overflow room for journalists, and God, poor guy, he has been through the ringer to get in there. You know, he arrived at the first trial, which started, you know, 9 or 9:30. He got there at 6 to make sure he would get in after doing all the kind of, you know, foundational back and forth about getting the right press pass and proving blah, blah, blah. So he gets there and there's like a bajillion people there, stands in line for 3 hours. And then they say, oh, that's it. It's full. Sorry about that. And all the other journalists kind of like clear out or go to interview the like five Trump protesters that are there or whatever. And Josh just kind of hangs around and then was rewarded for that because they come back out and they're like, okay, we've got two more seats for reporters. So Josh got in that way. Kudos to him. So it's fun that
we've... That's the kind of hardcore reporting work that you are supporting when you become a member of TPM, not screwing around, not taking a breather, interviewing the guy with the Trump flag, but keeping it real.
Good organic plug there. So it's been fun because we've gotten all this kind of color, and that's mostly what it is right now because we're still doing jury selection. And as our listeners can imagine, pretty difficult, I mean, anywhere in America, to find people who don't feel strongly one way or another about Donald Trump. But of course, these jurors are all coming from Manhattan specifically. So you're not even getting the kind of Republican flavored corners of New York, like Staten Island or whatever. It's they're all Manhattan people. So they've been bringing in kind of a bunch of prospective jurors, like 96 of them at a time, and then asking, are you able to be impartial for this trial? And then if anyone raises their hands, they're just dismissed. And that's like kind of interesting because if anyone has ever served on a jury before,
you know that
that's what everyone says, right? And then the judge and the lawyers kind of grill you to make, because a lot of people are just trying to get out of it, right? In this case, they're kind of giving you full benefit of the doubt. If you say you can't do it, you're gone. And they've been wiping out, you know, like kind of half these big groups that way. And then with the remaining people, you get this really long, like 40 question questionnaire to fill out. And then they're doing the more traditional kind of voir dire little interviews. And each side, the defense and the prosecution, gets 10 like no questions asked kind of dismissals that the judge can't interlude on and be like, no, that's not a good reason. So you get 10 of those, both sides per Josh, as of Tuesday. Today, Wednesday is a day off in the trial, but as of Tuesday, they'd both used 6 of those. And we've got now 7 jurors like placed on the jury. They want to get 12 with potentially 6 alternates. So that's where we are now. And there have been some moments of humor, you know, like at one point they asked this woman who's a prospective juror, you know, is she the traditional question of, are you related to any lawyers or do you have any, you know, any close people in your life that are lawyers? And she said that she dated one for a while, but they broke up. And then she said after a pause, it ended fine, which apparently made everyone laugh. So there have been like, you know, little moments like that. You had Trump getting scolded at one point because they were going over this woman's Facebook post where she had posted a video of everyone like celebrating after Biden won in 2020 and said something about, you know, fairly innocuous about like spreading cheer or something. And the judge was not letting the prosecution or letting the defense kind of just write her off completely because of that. And Trump started muttering at her and then he got scolded by the judge. So it's also, you know, you have the kind of split screen of this very, I don't know, very human experience of getting just a cross section of people from like all walks of life kind of here. And then you have Trump reacting to them. Like at one point, one of the prospective jurors was asked, you know, do you have any strong feelings about Donald Trump? And the guy said, I was a big fan of The Apprentice when I was a kid. And apparently, you know, Trump smiled at that. So you kind of, it's just a bizarre sounding experience. So, you know, that's where we're at now. Jury selection is actually moving a lot faster than people anticipated. Initially, they thought it might take 2 weeks to seat a jury because it's so hard to find people who don't have like preconceived notions about Trump. But, you know, as I said, we've got 7 now. So we're like more than halfway done. The judge said, if we continue at this pace, the whole jury will probably be in place by Friday and they can start with opening arguments Monday morning, which, you know, that's a pretty good clip.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I looked at some of the, I'm not sure if they were the transcripts or, you know, kind of basically reporter summaries of what the back and forth was about these different people, where they were in life and stuff like that, you know, what their professions were. I believe there were a few of them who were lawyers themselves, maybe not criminal defense, blah, 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 blah. But it is always one of these things where if someone says like, yeah, I really don't have a lot of strong feelings about Trump. You know, it's hard not to think either, you know, liar or what's your deal? Like, you know, because no one doesn't have strong feelings about Trump, right? There's no one who's just like, hasn't given it much thought or something like that. I mean, as you say, it's a big country and we have a very skewed, you and I and almost certainly everybody who's listening to this podcast, because by definition, you're into politics, you follow it and all that kind of stuff. And there are a lot of people out there. And certainly you're right. I mean, anybody who has served on a jury and either honestly or because you're busy, say, oh, I can't, you know, don't know if I can be, you know, impartial. I mean, that don't cut it. That, you know, I've had that a few times in cases where, you know, I kind of thought that might be the case. And yeah, they're, you know, the judge, I don't know if you've, you know, sometimes you get pressed by the judge where they're saying like, okay, you're saying we will swear, we're going to swear you in. And then you are not going to be able to follow the instructions I give you when you're under oath. And at that point, most people say like, okay, sorry, judge. Yeah. Okay. my bad. Right. So, but I guess in this case, I would assume, I mean, they're just trying to kind of move as quickly as they can and don't want to waste time on those conversations. But I would also assume they know this whatever happens in this trial is going to be, you know, processed so aggressively for appeal. Why do you want to have any juror who started off saying, no, I can't be impartial? Like, that's just why? Why do that, right? But it is interesting. It is one of the... There's something, it's certainly not uniquely American. We're not the only one, we're not the only country that has jury trials, but it is a cross section of America. And not every country has jury trials. And there is this kind of like, okay, you're out there just living your life as one person in America and you're going to have this big responsibility. So, you know, that whole thing.
It's so wild to think that, you know, you're getting called up for your jury duty and you walk in, you're like, oh shit, it's the Trump trial. You know, like that's crazy. It's just, it's funny. And there is this like cottage industry, which I was not super aware of before this, of juror investigations, which basically have people who look up, you know, potential jurors and kind of scour their social medias or, you know, on public voting rolls or see who they've given money to. Mm-hmm. And in this case, obviously, that's ratcheted up because both sides are trying to weed out what could potentially decide this trial, which would be if a juror feigning kind of blandness gets on, and then you're like, oh my God, this is, you know, the president of the Trump fan club of whatever, you know, the
right,
borough.
Right.
So that's going on throughout, and both sides have kind of tried to toss people because of their social media activity. But it's funny because the people who like get through that net are just, it's like you're saying, they're so... It's hard to imagine that such people exist to people like us who pay attention to politics. Like, we know that the foreman of the jury is an Irish immigrant who is a waiter with some college experience who primarily gets his news from MSNBC and Fox News and like one of the big newspapers. And just like, who are you?
What? Yeah. What is that? I mean, maybe if you work at a sports bar, they have Fox on and MSNBC sometimes. What am I talking about? They don't have news on at a sport, you know, right. So like,
yeah,
you're at a news sports bar, a news bar,
yeah,
right?
News themed bar. Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe, there's a little of that, like at a gym, you know, they'll have like, mm-hmm. you know, news on at a gym and something like that. But it does just raise these I don't know, kind of perverse sort of incentives in a case like this, in which you were essentially, I don't know, kind of ruling out about 80% of the population, probably.
At least, honestly.
There's you can have committed feelings on the big political questions, but that doesn't mean you're donating or, you know, kind of an anti-Trump meme lord or something like that on Twitter. I mean, you know, what is sometimes the standard rap on juries, which I think is mostly really unfair and kind of denigrating, this idea that, you know, you only have people who are basically ignorant of everything, right? And have this kind of slapdash way of, you know, have you ever heard about this? No. You know, it is unique. You know, I always have a kind of a grammarian angel sitting over my shoulder. I'm always afraid to use the word unique, but this is unique, right? This is something deeply polarizing. Everybody knows who he is. And so you can't, it certainly can't be, have you heard of him? That's not going to work. But we'll see, you know, who knows?
One thing about it that is a little concerning to me is the judge kind of previously put in some measures to preserve the jurors' anonymity for the very horrifying reason that, you know, mm-hmm. the Trump hordes are going to go after them. You know, best case scenario, that means like getting doxxed or harassed online. Worst case is someone will act on those impulses.
Yeah.
But he is not really stopping people from kind of outing themselves. And I have to say, just from some of the coverage I've seen, I mean, people, and I don't blame them, right? These are lay people. They're not necessarily thinking about if they're making themselves identifiable or not, but some of them are giving out so much information that there's just no way that you can't find some of them. And I know because, like, you know, we would never publish that, but as a kind of journalistic exercise, we've been able to kind of identify a few of these people just because, you know, you've got one person who works at a 3-person company with her husband who said the name of the company, and, like, you know, and people have said named their employers, and, you know, there is just, and that is worrisome to me because that is going to be, I mean, you've already got Trump kind of unleashed going after Judge Merchan's daughter and, you know, moving the boundaries of what's acceptable. And that always kind of trickles down to his followers. And it's just, you know, that after the trial is seated, he's going to pick out, you know, I'm sure whatever people of color are on it or women who are on it to decide that they are specifically kind of out to get him. And that is just, that's a scary proposition. Like, I do wish that there were a bit of like firmer guardrails on what journalists could get access to in terms of, you know, the identifying stuff.
Yeah, it's funny. There's I saw a journalist. Well, it was Jim Fallows, just on Twitter, kind of saying like, "What is the journalistic value? What is the news value of the mm-hmm. of what you're talking about? Of these, like, you know, even when it's not immediately identifying, just the general kind of I do this, I do that." And it had occurred to me that, you know, to the extent that someone wants to be on the jury, you know, it's kind of like trying to answer the right way or something like that. You sort of have to, like, who is that? Like, I've got some questions about the people who want to be on this jury, because you can kind of guarantee, I mean, either you're stupid because your life is going to get turned upside down, or you want to write a book, right? It's, and now, some people just want to do their civic duty. But it's almost like if you've really thought it through, those are the likely outcomes. I guess, I mean, our lawyers, you know, there are lots of things that judges can do, but I think basically how this works is they're doing this in open court, and that's how American trials operate. That's, you know, that is the overwhelming default. And certainly any effort to not make any part of this in open court, let alone any constitutional problems with that, would create a huge firestorm, blah, 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 blah. So it's an open court. members of the press can be there. That's what open court means. And you're not going to have like prior restraint about what they can do. I mean, obviously, you don't take pictures of them, but I'm not sure there's kind of any way around it. And as you say, to the extent that you are talking about people who are not awash in politics, they're not going to be thinking about, oh, well, kind of, you know, my employer only has 9 employees in Manhattan. So, you know, the people aren't going to be thinking about that. And frankly, it wouldn't be appropriate for you're supposed to just answer the question. You're not supposed to be like angling for, you know, my outability and stuff like that. So it is weird, and I'm not sure there's any way around it. But yeah, I mean, this is going to happen, and he doesn't even need to do it himself. Yeah. His people will do it for him. Can I ask you one quick question? When you said about I know about the, you know, researching people's backgrounds makes total sense. But I guess one thing I'm a little uncertain about is people don't get, you know, before you're impaneled, whatever, when you're in the pool, the time between when you're in the pool and when the decision made is, it's not weeks. It's pretty quick. So they must have people, you know, someone over in another room on laptops just doing identity searches really fast.
Totally. I mean, and it's a factor of even just like the pattern of the day, you know, like if you have a lunch break, you have kind of time to do this. But like when things were winding down on Tuesday, for example, everyone kind of thought they were going to quit for the day at 5, and then they kept going and they decided to question more jurors. And like you said, that created a situation where the lawyers were not really going to have much time to delve into the background there. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely a little bit on the fly. But, you know, as you say, with how you can't really change these conditions, isn't that just such a feature of the Trump era, where it's like you've got this very real threat of violence from Trump's followers? And also, it's the kind of perennial question of what do you do about it? You know, it's like you can't kind of upheave the way we do everything to avoid these people's violence. But then the other side of the coin is, you know, these jurors, much like the Georgia election workers or any of these kind of normal people who are plucked out to be villains in the MAGA universe, like those people have no protection at all. And, you know, the police maybe are the only ones who could do any kind of stand in there. But I mean, they're useless in this context, right? I mean, it really brings to mind Shay Moss and Ruby Freeman talking about after kind of Trump and Rudy Giuliani fingered them as the ones who had like stolen the election in Florida, you know, that they had people sending 1 million pizzas to their house and ringing the doorbell and trying to do a citizen's arrest on their, you know, on the grandmother. I mean, it's just, we have no guardrails for people like that. And it's just this like unsolvable problem, because it's like you say, what are you going to do? Kind of like shut courts to the press? You can't do that. Nobody wants that. I mean, and at this point, the only thing you can kind of rely on is like journalists being a little bit more responsible and maybe being able to sift out what is fun color from these otherwise kind of boring procedural early days of the trial and what is, you know, potentially endangering somebody.
Well, you know, there's a reason we call them guardrails and not laws, right? These things rely on, by definition, they rely on people operating within certain norms. And we have gotten used to the fact that it's just a given that people who are perceived to be threatening Trump will get lots of death threats and will quite likely get the kinds of harassment that isn't just anonymous emails, but people, you know, not maybe becoming a victim of physical violence, but if some whack job is, you know, comes up to you and wants to do a citizen's arrest and people are, you know, swatting your house and stuff, that's real, right? And at a certain level, like, how can we not take that as a given? It is a given. At the end of the day, what makes it, the decision is in the hands of his supporters, because the real hammer there is someone acts a certain way in a political context, and their supporters say, "Okay, that's too much. You're done." But as we know, that has never happened. In fact, it's clearly how he motivates a substantial number of his supporters, and that's just kind of where we are, right? There's no, I don't mean it in a kind of a throwing up our hands kind of way, but as with so many other things about Trump, at least a very large minority of the country is fine with him behaving this way. And that is the political reality that we currently live in.
So before we move off the Trump trial, I want to talk a little bit about the politics of it all, right? Like the political valence of Trump being stuck in a courtroom every day under penalty of arrest if he skips for, you know, 6 weeks, 2 months. That's kind of what we're looking at here. And this is something that we talked about a bit on the pod, you know, months ago, you know, back when we thought that these trials would be starting a lot more imminently than they ended up starting. But I have to say, we thought when we were talking about this back then that it would matter greatly that Trump was in court. And I think we talked about it a little bit in the context of having some skepticism about this idea that Trump in a courtroom helps him, right? That he gets to like come out every day and do these big angry speeches to the assembled reporters on the sidewalk and talk about how this is a, you know, Joe Biden prosecution and it's a witch hunt and they're doing this to keep him from the presidency. And a lot of people have given a lot of credence to the idea that that's a really potent argument for him. And I think, you know, insofar as our show has a quote unquote editorial perspective, e.g. kind of just the perspective of the two of us, it's that no, being stuck off the campaign trail for 2 months during the general election is not actually a boon to your campaign. It is bad for your campaign. It keeps you from, you know, traveling. It keeps you from doing rallies. It reminds people every single day that you have these serious felony charges against you, that you are in the kind of ultimately undignified position of being a criminal defendant, of being threatened with jail time, of being silenced, of being powerless, of having to sit there and take it, of for the first time in Trump's long, wealthy life, not getting to like craft his own schedule and kind of be the master of his own fate. I mean, it's ultimately humbling, even for Trump, who has gotten allowances that no other criminal defendant would ever get, who can go after the judge and know he won't get put in jail, you know, who for most of it avoided getting a mugshot or his fingerprints and has been treated differently still. And I have to say, I have been struck by how true that ended up being in this first week. And I think the only kind of downside is that it's not televised, because that would just intensify all of this. And, you know, we'd get the shots of Trump keeps falling asleep and that would be everywhere. But my God, it is something to see a man who has kind of based his entire political appeal on power yeah, that nobody can kind of, yeah, that no one can take away from him, that no one can impinge on. He's, you know, he's white, he's famous, he's wealthy, and all of those things make him kind of undefeatable. To see that all just kind of stripped away and have him have to sit there and sulk quietly, and the judge will yell at him if he mutters and he just has to sit still for hours on end. I mean, it's something.
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize that there are, yes, he's a white man and he's wealthy, but his, you know, secret sauce, for lack of a better word, is even above and beyond that. The things that apply to all the other white wealthy men don't apply to him. He's going to pull some fast one. And, you know, even back to the 2016 campaign, one of his big things, and this wasn't a matter of breaking rules or laws, but the way that every other campaign, his, you know, the candidates that he dispatched in relatively short order, they're going to respond you know, we'll put out a press release. We'll workshop it. And he's just on Twitter like, meh, 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 meh. And they're like, what, what? How? Or that, you know, in a debate, he's, you know, Jeb Bush will kind of put out his, you know, scripted one-liner. And then Trump is like, you know, Jeb, he's low energy. You know what I mean? And everybody's like, you know, like, dude, what? You know, so it is, even when you get beyond breaking rules, he not even norm, he operates outside of the constructs that are there. And obviously he also breaks rules or finds ways that the rules don't apply to him. And that is that sense of dominance, power. It doesn't, nothing applies to me. And that is really the center of his political power, because I think, you know, his people, the draw is, I want someone on my side who no rules apply to. I like that. I like that. I like that he's hurting everybody or hurting the right people. So yeah, I have the same sense that it doesn't look good at all. I mean, because dominance is his brand. So, you know, to put it in those kind of corny third decade of the 21st century language, you know, it's off brand. It's very off brand seeing him like this. And it clearly is internally difficult for him. And, you know, the one thing, even thing, I don't want to get, you know, too far afield in terms of like a psychological analysis, but, you know, it's great to see him falling asleep for, you know, to the extent that that plays into the, you know, the competitive old man-ism, you know, discourse of the 2024 election. But I wonder at some level, he's fallen asleep because he feels kind of defeated there. Oh, that plays with someone's head in weird ways. And, you know, the one thing that, I mean, I saw he gave a little speech lit yesterday afternoon, I guess, and I didn't see it till, you know, a couple hours after it happened, but he looked terrible. He looked awful. He did not look like himself. And I wonder in the one thing that confuses the issue for me a little bit is that Biden is clearly gaining on him in the polls. Who knows if it's going to stay that way? Who knows if Biden's gaining enough? But one of the things that we discussed on the pod a couple months ago during the fall is it's super hard to look smart when you're losing. You know, to the extent that when you're a little behind in the polls, you're losing. You know, you're, for the moment, you're losing. You're not where you want to be. You look weak. You look dumb. Everything that goes wrong is you're an idiot for doing it. So he is, at least in relative terms, falling back a little. So that's going to make everything he does that isn't optimal seem worse and weaker and dumber and stuff like this. And I have no question that our perceptions of him, you know, in the dock are affected by that. They can't not be affected by that. He's losing ground, but still it's just a defeated thing. It's not an accident that, you know, we have this hundreds of year English common law inherited by the United States tradition of there's all sorts of symbolism and process that are engineered to make clear the defendant, the state is in charge here. The government is in charge. You're not in charge. You are in the dock. You are answering for a crime. And he is subject to that as much as anybody. And in some ways, it's more damaging for him because dominance is his brand.
Totally. And there's also just the logistical reality of, I mean, this is a man who hasn't done anything that he doesn't want to do for like decades. I mean, most of us, part of being a normal human is like, you have to do things that are boring and long and that you don't want to do because it's just part of life. You know, you have to sit and wait in a doctor's office. You have to go to the DMV and wait in a 2-hour line. You have to go to jury duty and spend your whole day there seeing if you get picked. But for a, you know, super special wealthy celebrity man, Trump, he couldn't even sit for his daily national security briefings. You know, we have reporting of him just kind of getting up and toddling out of the room because he's just, he doesn't have the self-discipline that the rest of us are kind of forced to develop to just exist in society. So I'm just wondering if he's going to be able to sit there every day for 2 months. I mean, that seems like a psychic battle that he has no muscle memory to fight, you know? And you've got, it's just, it's good that they got this kind of no-nonsense judge who's like, you know, you are not going to kind of fuck around in my courtroom. You're going to follow the rules and you're going to sit there. And he's already, I mean, he's made abundantly clear, like, if you miss a day, you're going to jail. And I'm not going to let you out for campaigning stuff or because you want to sit at the Supreme Court for your immunity case. Like, this is the trial you have to be at and you will be here. And I think that's just going to be a, like, an epic internal struggle for him.
No, I mean, I was going to bring up the point about the presidency because, you know, one of the reasons that the presidency historically ages people a lot is that it is a tremendous amount of work, right? I mean, they say, Biden, Bush, they're vacationing constantly and all that kind of stuff. But even when you're, that's just a change of locale. You're still doing tons of stuff through the day and, you know, whatever. People, no one made you be president. Right. It's not, no one's like feeling sorry for anybody, but it was, as you said, it was a constant theme of his presidency. He just didn't want to do most of it. Right. And even I must say, I don't think for reasons of dominance, I mean, I don't want to be on trial for in a criminal court regardless, but I would have a hard time, not because of the sort of the tie, I would need like a fidget spinner, right? Because of my ADHD, I would have a hard time. But yeah, for him, it would have been nice if we had, and I'm a little curious because it's not a default, but I always think of it as a default that you're going to have cameras in the state court. I would like to have actually seen what that muttering thing was because from the sound of it, it sounds like it wasn't a kind of taunt so much as he couldn't help it. Like, you know, he couldn't not respond. And I do wonder if we're going to see more kind of like, I don't know, just he won't be able to hold it together. Right.
It really is like a kind of special, like divinely curated punishment for him to have to sit there and like listen to mean memes that people have tweeted or posted about him. You know, it's just like the poster king is kind of getting his comeuppance here.
Yeah.
So, you know, Josh will keep covering that. We'll keep being at the courtroom for us. So it's not going away. It's a story we're going to keep talking about for the next few weeks.
And the idea is it's 4 days a week with Wednesdays off, right? That's kind of outside
of... That's my understanding.
Okay. That's the default. Got it. Okay.
More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show. So, but we did want to talk about a couple other things in this episode, one of which we'll jump from one court to another. So this was yesterday on Tuesday. The Supreme Court heard this case that grew out of one of these prosecutions of an alleged insurrectionist on January 6th. You know, this particular guy was an active police officer who basically told his police chief, like, yeah, eat shit, I'm going to the Capitol, like, I might need bail money. And then, you know, in kind of beautiful harmony, the police chief was with the group that came to arrest him after the Capitol. So, but, you know, so this guy got into the building. He, like, seems to have knocked a police officer down. You know, his defense team is basically saying, oh, he was only in there for 4 minutes. But basically, he is on this, like, upper tier of kind of the insurrectionists, right? Like, we've had a lot of prosecutions of them. The lower tier are the people who were kind of, you know, didn't do anything violent, who, like, trespassed but didn't touch a police officer or bash in a window or steal a riot shield. And then the upper tier are the people who did do that. And, like, the really common thread that seems to bring these people together is they, like, really delightfully admit to all their crimes on social media or in text. But so this is an upper tier guy. So he got, I think, 6 different charges of, you know, ranging from the kind of trespass to, like, assaulty type stuff. And one of those charges was obstruction of an official proceeding, which, if it sounds familiar, is because that's one of the charges. Well, it kind of comprises 2 of the charges that Jack Smith has brought against Trump in the January 6th case. And that's why this, otherwise, you know, people wouldn't really care about the case of this one insurrectionist, but it matters because it could ripple into Trump's. So the kind of granular question that this is going up to the Supreme Court about is whether the government can use this anti-obstruction statute against the insurrectionists. And it is born from a statute that was passed after the Enron scandal. And the first kind of clause of this section about it is all about not spoiling evidence, you know, that you can't. And it was to close this loophole, because pre-Enron, other people destroying evidence kind of for you was a crime. But there was this loophole where if you destroy it yourself, that's fine. Like, that's not illegal. So they were closing this loophole, and then they added on. So they're like, you know, you can't kind of tamper, impair, blah, 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 all these different words for evidence. And then in the second part, it's like, or otherwise, you know, impede, delay, obstruct an official proceeding. And the government's been using that kind of catch-all provision to say, you know, these certain insurrectionists, they can't use it with all of them. The government says they've only used this charge with, like, 300 of them, because it's a higher bar, right? Like, you need to prove that they knew what was going on at the joint session of Congress, that they were specifically trying to get into the building to, you know, stop the count or delay the count at the least. You need to have, you know, there's a mens rea piece where you have to have a corrupt intention. So, you know, it's a higher bar to prove. They can't use this for people who just kind of waltzed into the Capitol and waltzed out. So that this whole argument was about, does that part of the statute apply here? Is the government kind of searching in statutes to find something that they could extend out to use here? And that's the defense's argument, right? Like, they're saying this is about evidence spoilation. They are just kind of finding a whole new statute in this provision. And the government's saying, look, you know, we're all textualists here. That's what it says. It says to corruptly obstruct an official proceeding. That's what this guy's doing, right? He's texting people. He's posting on social media. He knows what he was doing, what he was getting in there to do. You know, he sent a text that said members of Congress can't vote if they can't breathe. Like, he went with the intent. Yeah. To do this. And so Jack Smith kind of is trying to preempt this potentially going badly. He submitted some brief saying, look, no matter how this one goes, we have a direct tie-in to that more explicit evidence impairment piece of the statute, because Trump was trying to use the fake slate of electors. He was trying to, you know, make a phony document to try to
kind of evidence, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So he's saying, you know, no matter if you don't think the kind of siege of the building is enough, we have a backup plan, basically. And the arguments here were kind of interesting, because after the first, you know, the lawyer for the insurrectionist, after he went, I was pretty sure we were going to get a 9-0 in favor of the government. Like, they were very skeptical of this guy's argument. You know, it's a hard argument to make. Like, you're kind of taking the explicit words of the statute and being like, that's not what they mean. They, you know, this catch-all provision doesn't really mean anything. It's just kind of repeating what they said explicitly in the first, which is
right. Generally
not why people add catch-alls, especially in this context when Congress was really explicitly trying to close loopholes that, like, fancy money men used to get out of trouble. But then in the second half, you had Elizabeth Preliger, the Solicitor General, get up, and then the kind of conservatives really came out of the woodwork. And you had Gorsuch and Alito being kind of like Fox News brain pilled, where they kept saying, you know, well, what if the peaceful protesters, you know, who just blocked off the Golden Gate Bridge for a pro-Gaza protest, like, what if they had done that on the highways around the Capitol and stopped members from getting in? You know, does that count? What about pulling a fire alarm to delay a congressional vote? You know, they're bringing in all these very, like, identifiable liberal episodes.
Right.
And doing this kind of bad faith thing where they're pretending like they don't see a difference between, you know, what the insurrectionist did and what someone who stands up and heckles the Supreme Court in court is doing, like, as if those are two of kind of the same things. And you had Thomas doing a similar vein where he's like, well, there have been a lot of violent protests before. Has the government ever used this statute against them? You know, which is, you know, putting aside that it's kind of stunning to see Thomas, like, talking about the insurrection from the bench, knowing Ginny Thomas's role in trying to foment it. And then you had, you know, Barrett and Kavanaugh and Roberts did a little more of the more academic-y, you know, this is over breath. The government is kind of reaching with this statute. Kavanaugh did some, you know, some little, like, classically Kavanaugh whine where he's, like, trying to make sure no one's mad at him by being like, well, this guy's got other charges against him. It doesn't matter if we throw this one out.
Yeah,
don't be mad at me. And actually, Ketanji Brown Jackson seemed pretty skeptical of the government's argument as well, which may kind of have to do with the fact that she has this past as a public defender. And in that attitude, it's not crazy to take a posture that, like, you don't really want prosecutors digging around to find latent statutes to try to ensnare more people in a kind of criminal posture.
You know, one of the things I was going to say about that is it's interesting that she would say that, because in, like, drug cases, you often have it like, oh, you were charging you with selling cocaine. We're also charging you with conspiracy to sell something bad. That's mm-hmm. another charge. And conspiracy to feloniously hold something that is white and powdery. And, you know, these kind of like, what? Like, you're, and the courts generally treat that as just fine. Just mm-hmm. pile a whole bunch of crap on that. I mean, there's two different issues there. One is sort of, you know, using a kind of loose statute in a very expansive way. And then there's a arguably at least as bad issue of basically charging the same crime like 10 times
totally.
In different theories of it or something like that. So it's, I give her the credit of that muscle memory, because that is legitimate, at least as a reflex to scrutinize that. I mean, it's a little hard for me to, in my own mind, navigate between, okay, how about how it always works? Are we going to depart from how it always works because you actually like the insurrection and you think
exactly.
it's awesome. So we're going to do something totally different. That's, you know, that's a slippery slope to operate on. You know, the other point about those other, you know, Golden Gate Bridge and all these kind of stuff, I don't know the legal theory or legal doctrine or whatever, but very often the way you settle that issue is, and again, there's some principle involved here, but it's basically like, okay, if you just did that by, you know, theoretically making something harder by some random thing you did that is categorically different than if you broke the law to do it. And so, and just the pretty commonsensical thing that if there's something that you are not allowed to do, if you theoretically kind of accomplished it through totally legal means, that is entirely different from if the means that you used to accomplish it were themselves criminal. And in this case, you're not allowed to break into the Capitol building, right? You're not allowed to break into the Capitol building. You're not allowed to tackle police officers. So that seems pretty straightforward to me. And look, it's to be fair to the justices, even though in as reporting on the specific, you know, the specific questions has, you know, there's more and more posturing with the court, you know, as they try to get their questions in. But, you know, they can ask questions and kind of sound out what your theories are. They're not bound to those, but I don't know. It is, you know, on the basic point that you laid out at the beginning of our conversation about this, about, you know, an official proceeding, like it's an official proceeding. You know, there is, and again, I'm kind of back there to this question of like, are we talking about how things should be? Are we talking about that it's not right to radically depart from how things are? But like, judges are generally need to keep within pretty tight bounds when it comes to saying, okay, you really shouldn't have passed that law because I don't know why. I don't know why you shouldn't have passed it, but you didn't mean to pass it or something. You know, I mean, because I guess they're saying here that, okay, if Congress would have said, hey, we can't have people, you know, coming into a courtroom and making a trial stop or preventing people from voting or coming into Congress and preventing them from, you know, completing a presidential election. Okay, well, then that would have worked. But in fact, they were doing this Enron thing. So kind of like that doesn't count. But like, why? Just, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that I found frustrating, especially about like some of the coverage. The Politico legal guy kind of did this big scoldy tweet that was like, anyone who tells you they know how this is going to come down is lying to you. This is a hard question. And what's frustrating about that is it's so context free because it's what you're saying. Like, should judges in general question prosecutors more and kind of question the statutes that are used to, as you say, you know, load up the punishments by kind of charging essentially the same thing over and over and over? Of course. But the only context in which right-wing judges do that is when it's a pro-Trump mob. You know, if we were talking about like a black drug dealer here, it would not be a question. So it's just, it's a little frustrating when you hear, you know, them like quibbling over like 20 years in federal prison. And it's that sympathy is so selectively applied. You know, it's just, anyway, I just...
We as a society, we send people to totally insane amounts of incarceration, and I don't just mean that on you know across the board. I mean for white collar criminals too, right? You know, the on some of those even some of the Trump cases with like God, I'm forgetting everybody's name. There were enough Trump cases of people who were, in theory, facing a lot of time in jail. And I remember thinking, like, and these are people who A, were guilty of very serious crimes, and who I totally despise. But I remember thinking, like, wow, that is way too long to sentence someone to prison. I remember, you know, going back to that jury selection thing. I sat on a case in D.C. more than 20 years ago. Little street drug dealing, street level drug dealing. And I was already very skeptical of just the national drug laws in general. And I kind of went into it with the attitude of like, I'm really going to hold the government to a very strong standard here. That's my way of conducting myself here. And it was a split, you know, the jury convicted on one thing and not on the other. And I remember when I was there for, I don't know if I was there for sentencing, but there was some discussion that kind of gave a sense of what this guy was probably going to get. That guy got like 15 years in prison, just like a kid, like a 20-year-old kid who was like, I can't remember if it was, maybe it was, you know, pot, the joints laced with something. I don't know. It wasn't, you know, wasn't nothing, but like, what the fuck? I mean, that is insane. And just in general, we have gotten as a society, I think inured, I mean, lots of people are not inured. They have family members in jail, but, inured to even something like 5 years in prison. Imagine spending 5 years locked in a box, let alone whether you're going to get like raped or, you know, like brutalized, just assuming it all goes how it's theoretically supposed to go. That's insane. Right. Anyway, another topic, but, we do lose a sense of like what these kind of, you know, I remember just one more point that, that Enrique Terrio guy, right, who mm-hmm. was the sort of the Proud Boys guy. I think he got like 17 years in prison for, you know, for his role. And that was a different thing. He wasn't even there on January 6th, but he played a key role in the people who were really planning the whole thing. And he got 17 years. And I remember people saying like, oh my God, he, you know, is that enough? That's, you know, that's not what, this is a serious crime. And like, I get it at a certain level, but man, spending 17 years in federal prison, that is, you don't have to be like diminishing the gravity of what happened on January 6th to say like, that's a ton. I'm not saying it's unfair, yeah. But like, that is a massive life-changing punishment.
Totally. So we'll be waiting to see kind of what the justices say there. I think in terms of how this will affect Jack Smith's case, if they want to shoot down the statute in a way that also kind of wipes out his backup plan of the phony certificates, they made that really difficult for themselves on Tuesday. And again, like, this is a right-wing, results-oriented court. We're not going to like sit here and be idealistic about it, but they did all agree. Like, it's explicit about the evidence thing. You know, that's written right in there. A lot of them were taking their qualms from the position of like, we're talking about documents, we're talking about, you know, photos and stuff like that. That's not what the insurrection was. So for him to kind of be like, well, here's our document piece, you know, that's going to be kind of harder for them to wipe away with this opinion, I think. Of course, now maybe they'll come back and say like, it wasn't evidence, but it'll be a harder row to hoe after the way they kind of talked during these arguments. So now we're going to round out the episode with another embattled week in the life of Mike Johnson, who basically has his feet in the fire again after the Iranian attacks on Israel over the weekend, which re-upped the urgency for doing foreign aid stuff. And like, you know, Israel and Ukraine and Taiwan are all just to some degree in tandem now. Even if Republicans don't want them to be, Democrats are never going to just sign off on Israel without getting Ukraine and Taiwan in, because they know that's the only way to get it done. So that has all kind of come up to the fore again. And then you have Marjorie Taylor Greene going on and on about the motion to vacate and how she is ready to do that. And then this week, Thomas Massie said, you know, he will kind of also sponsor a motion to vacate, and you have people getting pissy with Johnson because, as we've said before, there are a lot of people in the House, a lot of Republicans in the House who want to do Ukraine aid, you know, even more who want to do Israel aid. So we started getting more discussion again about a motion to discharge to kind of circumvent Johnson, which he could even perhaps usher behind the scenes, because it would be a way of getting this stuff to the floor that doesn't like necessarily kind of implicate him as the one shepherding the bills. But right before we started recording, he put out a letter to the members where he said they're going to release the text today of this supplemental that'll have Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan in it, which would set up a vote Saturday night. He said, the other way that he's going to kind of soothe the right wing of the party is he's going to bring up like a bundle of other stuff that they want to pass, the TikTok ban, the initial immigration bill that'll never go anywhere with Democrats, and kind of bring them up simultaneously to try to soften the blow of like helping Ukraine. So that's on the docket. The text, at least as of when we started recording, hasn't been released yet. And Democrats are largely kind of keeping their powder dry until they see what's in it and see if it's generous enough, you know, to kind of satisfy them. Even though at this point, I think, you know, Republicans would really have to poison pill it up to put forth any kind of Ukraine aid that Democrats would shoot down, because it's proven so difficult to get through. So that's where we are now. And it's, you know, Johnson said earlier this week, "I will not resign." Never really a comforting statement to hear from someone in a position of power. He, you know, there's the question of, you know, if he does this, Marjorie Taylor Greene said that her hill she'll die on is if he brings Ukraine aid to the floor, she's going to trigger the motion. And if she does, that'll bring up the question of, do Democrats step in? You know, do they help save him? Do they help table the motion, basically, which would kind of get rid of it for now? And you have some Republicans countering, well, if they, how many times are we going to do this? Is this going to be every time we're in session, there's a motion to vacate and you need Democratic votes every time? And some Democrats are saying, well, we're not going to do this for free, though it does, it feels like if he potentially loses the gavel for Ukraine, that they would probably help him out. And there is a general sense that Johnson has been a better faith negotiator with them than Kevin McCarthy was, who also made a kind of fatal error of going on TV and railing at all the Democrats, as well as the kind of ousting aide when he was in the midst of this, which didn't really incline them to help him. So that's where we are now. You know, Johnson is referring to himself as like a wartime speaker, which is pretty funny. yeah, and that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, it's funny that I think you are right, but it's funny that you say that they think he's more on the level with them than McCarthy was, because by most standards, McCarthy was, you know, moderate doesn't mean anything, but McCarthy was not an ideologue, right? He's just not an ideologue. I don't think he really has particularly strong policy feelings about anything. Johnson clearly is a hardcore ideologue, right? But what did undo McCarthy to a great extent was he was arrogant. He was arrogant, and knowing, or should have known that he might need Democrats to kind of, in a pinch, he was attacking them, and you know, so that all makes sense. It's just weird that they might. I mean, I saw that earlier today that the Democratic leadership was telling its members, hey, Republicans come to you talking about saving Johnson's speakership, you tell them just sign the discharge petition. You know, we've got a way out of this. Don't, you know, and that makes perfect sense. And I guess you made the point that there are ways that Democrats can short circuit this without having to vote for him in that floor vote, that you can basically join on committee and just, there's never a vote. And that's unquestionably would be easier for Democrats. And I think that is, I think that is the case. I think procedurally that's how this works. And if that is how this works, you know, that would just be easier for Democrats, because no one quite knows, like, oh, there's some committee somewhere and a couple people voted something. It would just inevitably be hard for Democrats, any Democrats, even a small number of Democrats, to kind of raise their hand, or, you know, metaphorically raise their hand for Mike Johnson. I mean, I would say that we're I'm trying to remember back, you know, one of the dimensions to the fight where McCarthy got thrown overboard is that he had already agreed to the big stuff. You know, Democrats didn't really care, right? There was nothing on the line. There was nothing where he could say, if you don't do this, the government is going to shut down, or we're going to default on our debt or something. You know, Democrats could sort of look on and say, like, we already got our stuff. Bye, Kevin. Like, you suck. You really suck. We hate you. You're nasty. You're blah, 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 blah. But here, the Ukraine thing is just a really, really big deal. I mean, to me, it's far, I mean, just on the merits, it's far more important than the Israel stuff. And that is not even, that's not even about Israel. It's, and obviously, you know, there's a lot of among Democrats and even between me and some of our readers, people, but they've got an army, right? There's not like they're not like using like rubber bands to shoot their missiles like they are in Ukraine. So, yeah, what I was asking you, Kate, before we started, and we punted it to you know, preserve all the goodness for you, the listeners, to go through it. This all may have happened by the time you listen to this podcast, but it is, does this have to come down to it today? Or is there something about today, or can this just bleed into tomorrow and the day after that in, you know, infinitely?
Yeah, no, the bleed is right. He put out this statement that we're going to get text today. So that sets up a vote for Saturday, and that the existence of an actual bill might kind of scuttle the discharge petition stuff a little bit, because he's basically saying, I'm putting this on the floor, right? Like, I'm going to kind of stand up to the motion to vacate. Like, I'm going to face it myself. So that might take the wind out of that sails, because Republicans were generally not psyched about that to begin with. I mean, some of them express sentiments like, you know, I don't do discharge petitions while I'm in the majority, you know, like my party's in control, which is
right, fair.
So I think as of now, unless something happens and the text doesn't come out, or the text comes out and Democrats are like, this is unacceptable, we're not doing this, or, you know, Republicans purposely try to sink it in some way, like say, no, it must be joined with our crazy immigration stuff, or we'll defund the IRS, you know, absent that, if the foreign aid supplemental is like kind of reasonable to some degree, if it mirrors what's come out of the Senate, stuff like that, I would assume that we're going to have the Saturday vote that will pass, you know, with many Democratic votes. And then the question is just, do Democrats kind of help Johnson keep his job? If the Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massie agitating kind of comes to fruition. And like you've been saying with the importance of Ukraine, I think Johnson's like best way to keep his job is if he is putting it on the line for Ukraine in terms of kind of Democratic sympathies. And then, you know, I've heard people kind of respond to that, like, well, what way is that to govern? It's like, well, what way is this to govern? I mean, it's ridiculous. The Republicans have no kind of control over the majority as it is. So, you know, making even more abundantly clear that all but the craziest ones are reliant on Democrats to pass anything isn't going to be like a breaking news bulletin to anyone who's been paying any attention for the past few months.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I certainly reject this idea like, oh, to bring the country together, Democrats have to save Mike Johnson and all that's nonsense. But kind of like, would you throw him a bone now just to get this Ukraine thing done? Like, why not? Like, you know, and the one reason why I'm not sure that will work is that the Marjorie Greens and Tom Massies and all the rest can say, okay, they threw you a bone, let's do it next week. Because I don't think they're going to infinitely throw you a bone going forward. So I don't even know. And I certainly don't think Democrats should or will agree to, oh, we'll backstop you. You know, there's ways in a parliamentary system they have, you know, to do this, have those kind of arrangements. Democrats aren't going to do that. But now, let me ask you one question. I saw an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution overnight that said kind of Green was getting a little wobbly on whether she wanted to do this. Have we picked that up in the discussion in D.C. this morning? Or is that more kind of, you know, people interpreting smoke and stuff like that?
My sense is that that is been somewhat consistent, right? Like the last time this happened, she was like, I'm putting it on the floor, and then ended up not really doing that, you know, not doing the other step that would make it have any binding power. So it was really just a messaging bill. You know, I think fundamentally, like, she loves being the center of attention, and this gives her a way to be it at all times. And I think the Massie thing riled this up a little bit more because people had gotten a little bit comfortable kind of saying, okay, that's Marge, right? That's what she does. And now you've got kind of another person. But yeah, I mean, she and he will have to be kind of comfortable doing this against the will of the entire conference. And I know that these are shameless people, but that's a hard thing to do when you're kind of sitting in the room and working with all these people every day. And so I don't know, I can see a world where he puts the stuff on the floor, including the Ukraine stuff, and it passes. And then they're like, we don't want to get into a speakership fight, so we're going to clog up the floor for a few days or do their kind of other methods of punishment. But ultimately, you know, this is tea leaf reading about like Marjorie Taylor Greene. So it's only so useful. Like her mind could be changing kind of daily at this point. But the wobbliness is interesting because it does reflect a little bit the idea that even in this like totally shameless conference, I mean, the October speakership fight was like traumatic for these people. And I mean, where would they go from here? Like, if not like Johnson, then who, you know?
Yeah, I do that. That's why I was curious about that, because I, you know, as you said, she wants attention. And so she want, and she would even more want not just the attention, but, oh, you know, Mike Johnson got out of line and Marjorie Taylor snapped him right back. You know, you're going to get the murals of muscle bound Marjorie Taylor, right? Kind of slapping Mike Johnson into line. But if he actually says, okay, let's do it, let's actually do it. I'm not so sure, because as you said, that was a really traumatic event for all of them. They're still kind of like deeply traumatized for it. So I could, and what we've seen, you know, Matt Gaetz, he's kamikaze, right? He doesn't care and he's weird. And what we certainly, I mean, she sort of picked the wrong horse with Kevin McCarthy, but what we've seen is she wants to be a player and not just a kind of an Andy Biggs player. She wants to be someone who's actually in the room and all that kind of stuff. So I could see her kind of getting a little wobbly if he says, you know, okay, let's do it. Let's see if you're really going to do this. And I even wonder, I'm actually curious, this gets us way too far into speculation, but it's a podcast, so it is what it is. I actually wonder, did Tom Massey consult with her, or did he just kind of do it on his own? In which case, that may actually have changed the equation for her without quite realizing it. Then it's just kind of back there, and suddenly he joins, and she's like, okay, because that's two votes. And what do they have, like a third of a vote majority now? I mean, they don't have any, you know, they don't have any margin at all. So anyway, you may know the answer to this question, because you are living in the future. Are you listening to the podcast in the future? And hopefully you're alive to be listening to it. It would be tragic if you weren't. But I think, you know, we'll see on this. And again, for what it's worth, I would think throwing him a bone to get a big chunk of Ukraine aid in motion would be well worth it, because what is the point of principle that anybody's worried about? You know, this house is not doing anything. It's basically just broken, and it'll remain broken for the rest of the calendar year. So whatever. So, you know, why not, to the extent that you care about my opinion? I think that's it for us, right? We covered we set ourselves an ambitious goal of covering these three topics, and I think we have done that. So let me just thank everybody one more time about the membership drive. It really went well for us, and we were totally psyched. And as you know, just speaking for everybody, we really appreciate it. And I think that's it, right? We'll be back next week.
See you next week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.